fairly self-evident that what Anthony Blinken and other U.S. officials told the Palestinian leadership is that unless you hand over the bullet that killed Shirin Abu Akleh and allow us to put this matter to rest by essentially saying that no conclusion can be reached, we're not going to throw you the bone of a presidential visit to the Palestinian Authority leadership. And that's essentially what happened.
Muin, I wanted to get your response to what's happening now. On Wednesday, the Israeli military conducted large-scale raids across occupied West Bank, detaining at least 42 Palestinians, shooting dead a 20-year-old man named Rafiq Riyad Ghanem during a raid in the village of Jabba near Jenin. This coming just 3 days after the Israeli military shot dead 18-year-old Palestinian Kamel Awana in the same village. These are the areas that Shireen covered for so long in these kinds of actions.
Yes, I mean, you know, it's par for the course. You cannot have a military occupation without consistent, violent repression to maintain that occupation. It's, you know, history over the past few thousand years demonstrates that conclusively. And what you have here is the Israelis focusing in particular on the northern West Bank and Jenin and its environs, because that is an area that is under somewhat less firm control of the Palestinian Authority and its security forces, who have been working very hard to ensure peace and quiet for the maintenance of the Israeli occupation. And it's in that context that you're seeing these constant raids. And it's quite likely also that the murder of Shirin Abu Akleh was in part to scare off the media from that area so that Israel could have a freer hand in conducting the kinds of activities that you just mentioned.
Well, Muin Rabbani, we want to thank you for being with us. Of course, we'll continue to cover this issue. Dutch-Palestinian analyst, co-editor of Jadalia. He's also hosts the Connections podcast. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Fels, Mike Burke, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay safe.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Big Float X on Sunday, July 10th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Tom McCall Bowl in Portland. The Big Float X is the 10th anniversary and final iteration of the Big Float, Portland's celebration of the Willamette River. Festivities include a pre-float parade, live music, and after-party. That's the Big Float X on Sunday, July 10th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Tom McCall Bowl, 90 Southwest Nito Parkway in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio and the Jazz Society of Oregon are proud to present the 42nd Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Friday, July 15th through Sunday, July 17th at Cathedral Park in North Portland. Jazz, blues, soul, and Latin musicians will rock the park for 3 days. Tony Coleman, Eddie Martinez, Outer Orbit, and Greater Kind are just a few of the 15 bands performing this year. That's the 42nd Annual Cathedral Park Jazz Festival, Friday, July 15th through Sunday, July 17th, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Smooth mind, floating like a butterfly, no set of float, sung like a lullaby, brace yourself.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, drug overdoses in Oregon doubled between 2019 and 2021. Derek Chauvin has been sentenced to 21 years in federal prison for his role in the murder of George Floyd. And in international news, the former Prime Minister of Japan has been assassinated. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 8th, 2022. I'm Josh Salem. An Oregon Health Authority analysis released yesterday stated drug overdose deaths in Oregon more than doubled between 2019 and 2021. The rise has largely been driven by misuse of the powerful synthetic opioid fentanyl. In 2021, nearly a third of Oregon's counties saw more people die from fentanyl overdose than from overdose related to any other drug. Preliminary information indicates that the trend is continuing this year. As a result, officials are urgently looking for increased supplies of the rescue drug naloxone, which rapidly reverses an opioid overdose. Dr. Dean Seidlinger, health officer and state epidemiologist at the Oregon Health Authority, said in a statement, quote, "We are seeing a critical need for naloxone, as many communities experience dramatic increases in overdoses due to fentanyl misuse. We encourage everyone in Oregon to educate themselves and their loved ones, including young people, about the importance of naloxone, how to use it in an overdose emergency, and where people can access it," end quote. Health officials warned yesterday that pills not obtained directly from a pharmacy, from sources like social media, the internet, or friends, may be counterfeit and may contain fentanyl. Officials also said anyone actively using opioids can get naloxone at no cost through syringe service programs, even if they do not inject the drugs. Currently, naloxone can be obtained at needle exchanges run by Multnomah County, the nonprofit Outside In, and independent peer-run groups like the Portland People's Outreach Project. They also suggest people who are taking prescription opioids should ask their healthcare provider or pharmacist for a naloxone prescription. A recent report by an independent panel of special education experts chosen by the Oregon Department of Education found that over 1,000 Oregon school children with disabilities are being denied their right to full school days and educational opportunities. As reported by the Oregonian, numerous schools across Oregon are responding to the needs of students with autism, emotional disturbance, and other forms of neurodivergence by simply shortening their hours of instruction rather than giving them the attention they need to succeed. According to the report, by reducing school time and chances to interact with other students, these arrangements, quote, put them in a position to lag further and further behind their peers in both academic and social-emotional skills, end quote. It's also likely illegal, as it contradicts federal law and a 2017 state law that requires equitable schooling for these kids, including education plans that move the students towards less restrictive learning environments. The report is part of an ongoing legal battle that began when Disability Rights Oregon sued the Education Department in 2019 in an attempt to get them to enforce the 2017 law. According to the report, in the 2018 to 2019 school year alone, 1,029 students were placed on shortened school days statewide. Elected officials in Oregon and across the country are calling on Congress to get serious about actions to mitigate climate change. Eric Tegetthoff has more on the story.
Elected officials in Oregon and across the country are calling on Congress to speed up the transition to clean energy. At least 20 elected officials in the state signed a letter to congressional leaders alongside 550 other officials across the U.S. Oregon State Representative Paul Evans, a Democrat from Monmouth, says passing the climate provisions in the Build Back Better bill is crucial. He says it's important to find a way to motivate people to understand the scale of climate change.
We're in the fight for the survival of our planet, and you either get on the team or you need to find something else to do, because it is our responsibility as human beings to ensure that we pass this planet on to the next generation and the generations that come with at least a possibility of having a livable, meaningful future.
The letter says renewable energy is key not only to save the planet, but also so the country can gain energy independence, which it says is important for national security. The Build Back Better legislation passed by the House has been stalled since last year. Republicans have opposed it, citing its price tag of $2 trillion over the next decade. Debbie Serignana is an Air Force veteran and state representative in New Mexico who signed on to the letter. She says Western states are facing a major crisis right now, with widespread drought, wildfires, and water shortage. Saranyana says the Build Back Better Act would inject $550 billion into a clean, renewable infrastructure and create jobs.
The legislation has been stalled, but it's not too late for the Senate to do the moral thing and join the majority of Americans in taking action against climate change and enacting legislation that will do so.
Kevin Johnson also is a veteran and co-founder of the Clean Energy Freedom Campaign. He says Build Back Better would benefit veterans.
There's tens of thousands of veterans like myself working in this clean energy industry. And if we can get our Congress and our Senate to move forward on this Build Back Better bill, it would unlock a tremendous amount of economic opportunity for veterans and across our country.
The federal government reports roughly 9% of workers in the solar and wind sectors are former military. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
A federal judge just sentenced Derek Chauvin to 21 years in prison for violating George Floyd's civil rights. Yesterday, U.S. District Judge Paul Magnuson criticized Chauvin for his actions back in May of 2020, though he opted for the low end of a sentencing range called for in a plea agreement. Chauvin had pinned Floyd to the pavement outside a Minneapolis store for more than 9 minutes, even as the black man said he was unable to breathe and then became unresponsive. Floyd's killing led to worldwide protests over police brutality and racism. Magnuson presided over the federal trial and convictions of three other officers at the scene earlier this year. But he blamed Chauvin alone for what happened. Chauvin was the senior officer present among the police team responding to a 911 call accusing Floyd of using a counterfeit $20 bill to buy cigarettes. The judge said, quote, "You absolutely destroyed the lives of three young officers by taking command of the scene," end quote. Chauvin's plea agreement called for a sentence of 20 to 25 years, to be served concurrently with a 22-and-a-half-year sentence for his state convictions for murder and manslaughter. Because of differences in parole eligibility in the state and federal systems, Chauvin will serve slightly more time behind bars than he would have on the state sentence alone. He would be eligible for parole after 15 years on the state sentence, but must serve about 18 years of his federal time before he can be released. He will also do his time in the federal rather than the state system. Chauvin's attorney, Eric Nelson, said he was remorseful and would make that clear to the court. But Chauvin made no direct apology or expression of remorse to Floyd's family. Prosecutor Leanne Bell asked Magnuson to give Chauvin the full 25 years possible under the plea deal. Bell said, quote, "He wasn't a rookie. He knew what his training was. He admitted before this court that his conduct was wrong, and he did it anyway," end quote. Floyd's brother also asked for the maximum possible sentence. Chauvin's guilty plea included an admission that he willfully deprived Floyd of his right to be free from unreasonable seizure, including unreasonable force by a police officer. It also included a count for violating the rights of a 14-year-old black person whom he restrained in an unrelated case in 2017. Magnuson has not set sentencing dates for the three other officers who are on the scene. Former Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe died after being shot during a campaign speech today. Abe, 67, was shot minutes after he started the speech in the city of Nara. He was airlifted to a hospital for emergency treatment, but was later pronounced dead. Police arrested the suspected gunman at the scene. Abe, known as an arch-conservative, was Japan's longest-serving prime minister when he stepped down in 2020. Credited with bringing a degree of stability to Japan, Abe had also been criticized for calls to revise the country's so-called pacifist constitution. His political rhetoric often focused on a stronger military and giving Japan a bigger role in international affairs. Nara Prefectural Police confirmed the arrest of Tetsuya Yamagami, age 41, on suspicion of attempted murder. The suspect served in Japan's Navy for 3 years and allegedly said he wanted to kill Abe because he had complaints that were not related to political views. Current Prime Minister Fumio Kishida and his cabinet ministers returned to Tokyo after the shooting. Kishida called it, quote, "dastardly and barbaric," end quote, and pledged to carry out Sunday's parliamentary elections as planned. Abe was still highly influential in the governing Liberal Democratic Party and headed its largest faction, Seiwake. Opposition leaders condemned the attack as a challenge to Japan's democracy. Abe became Japan's youngest prime minister in 2006 at age 52, but his first stint abruptly ended a year later because of health issues. He returned to office in 2012 and won 6 national elections. Abe's ultra-nationalism riled neighboring countries, including the Koreas and China, and his push to create what he saw as a more normal defense posture angered many Japanese. Abe failed to achieve his goal of formally rewriting the U.S.-drafted pacifist constitution because of poor public support. The Japanese government plans to review its security, but said that Abe had the highest protection. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Let's Talk About Race, and at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear to partly cloudy, with a low of 57. Tomorrow's weather will also be partly cloudy, with a high of 81. Today in history, in 1948, the United States Air Force accepted its first female recruits into the Women in Air Force, or WAF, program. The quote of the day is from Michelle Hauer, the first four-star female admiral in the U.S. Navy, who said, "How many of us have had our hearts broken for whatever reason, yet find the courage to continue to reach out for love." January 6th committee hears from key witness. With more on the story, it's Mary Sherman with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. The January 6th committee hears today from a highly sought-after witness.
It's a partisan impeachment that they've delivered to your doorstep in an election year.
Former White House counsel Pat Cipollone, who defended former President Donald Trump during his 2020 impeachment trial, sits down for a closed-door transcribed interview by the committee. Cipollone was at the heart of last week's testimony from White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson, who said Cipollone was concerned Trump could face criminal charges if he joined protesters at the Capitol.
Mr. Cipollone said something to the effect of, "Please make sure we don't go up to the Capitol, Cassidy." In the days leading up to the 6th, we had conversations about potentially obstructing justice or defrauding the electoral count.
The testimony could pave the way for an investigation into whether Trump tried to obstruct or conspire against the government. On his social media platform, Truth Social, Trump expressed concern the testimony could undermine the relationship between future presidents and their White House counsel. Meanwhile, the committee's next hearing is Tuesday, July 12th at 10 a.m., followed by a primetime hearing next Thursday. The Treasury Department has been asked to investigate IRS audits of former FBI Director James Comey and former Deputy Director Andrew McCabe, who are both critics of President Trump. Several lawmakers said it's difficult to believe the audits were coincidental, but the IRS said it's untrue to suggest they were politically motivated. House Democrats are inviting the CEOs of three gun manufacturers to testify in a July 20th hearing in the wake of a mass shooting in Highland Park, Illinois. There's increasing pressure on lawmakers to do more on gun safety. However, the prospects for another deal appear unlikely. President Joe Biden honored late Senator John McCain with the Medal of Freedom, noting his close relationship with a Republican.
We ran against each other, which I didn't like, on tickets to the highest office in the land. I was the candidate for vice president. He was the candidate for president. I never stopped admiring John, never said a negative thing about him in my life, because I knew his honor, his courage, and his commitment. That was John McCain.
16 other recipients included gun violence survivor, former Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, Olympic gymnast Simone Biles, and Sandra Lindsay, the first American to receive a COVID-19 vaccine. Boris Johnson stepped down as leader of Britain's Conservative Party on Thursday, but will remain prime minister until the party chooses a new leader.
I want you to know how sad I am to be giving up the best job in the world. But them's the breaks.
The resignation comes after dozens of his cabinet members quit, saying they could no longer serve under his leadership. In election news, Ballotpedia research shows there are 28% more contested primaries this year than in 2020. These are primaries with more candidates than available nominations. The number of Democratic primaries rose in 11 states and decreased in 15. On the Republican side, primaries increased in 27 states and decreased in 3. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
A lengthy report issued today by U.S. Customs and Border Protection says that its agents used, quote, unnecessary force, end quote, during an incident in 2021 at the Rio Grande River near Del Rio, Texas. As reported by Al Jazeera, on September 19th of last year, Video appeared to show CBP agents on horseback, quote, whipping, end quote, Haitian migrants who had already crossed the river into the United States. CBP Commissioner Chris Magnus said today that on multiple occasions, quote, mounted agents used force or the threat of force to drive migrants back into the Rio Grande River, despite the fact that the migrants were already within the United States, end quote. He blamed the incidents on multi-level failures at the agency, lack of appropriate policies and training, and, quote, unprofessional and dangerous behavior, end quote, by specific agents, one of whom, Magnus said, made offensive comments about migrants' national origin and gender. However, Magnus denied that migrants were struck with the horse reins that the video apparently shows agents swinging towards them. This prompted a lawyer with a migrant advocacy group, Haitian Bridge, to point out on Twitter that the report contains no interviews with any of the migrants present that day. The U.S. Supreme Court issued a recent ruling that threatens tribal sovereignty and jurisdiction over Native land. With that story and more, it's Mark Hughes with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonio Gonzalez. The recent U.S. Supreme Court decision in the Castro Huerta case represents an immediate and lasting threat to tribal sovereignty. That's the main message from a virtual roundtable discussion organized by the National Congress of American Indians and the Native American Rights Fund on Thursday. During the discussion, NCAI President Fawn Sharp calls the decision nothing less than a direct attack on the sovereignty of all tribes.
At a time we need it the most, and at a time when we've worked so hard to secure it, the very foundation is now shaken and 200 years unraveled.
Among other things, the ruling limits Native jurisdiction over non-Native people who commit crimes on Native land. Native legal experts say it is a departure of more than a century of precedent and practice. Several of the participants highlighted the need for educating elected leaders and the general public on a daily basis about tribes' inherent rights. Muscogee Creek Nation Principal Chief David Hill said it's hard to see any justification for opposing more public safety resources on tribal land or anywhere else.
We're going to have to be strategic and smart and understand that this fight may take a long time, but we, Muscogee Creek Nation, are up to the task.
Some participants expressed optimism about some positive outcomes from the ruling. Cherokee Nation Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. said he has mixed feelings about the court's ruling. He said it is a severe blow to tribal sovereignty, but at the same time, the ruling leaves in place the landmark McGirt ruling that says Congress never disestablished reservations in Oklahoma, home of the Cherokee, Muscogee Creek, and many other tribes. Arizona's newly approved record $18 billion state budget also includes a record appropriation for projects on tribal lands. The Arizona Mirror reports the spending plan includes $55 million, mostly for infrastructure projects on the Navajo Nation. The state's three Navajo legislators call the appropriation historic. Nevertheless, Navajo President Jonathan Nez criticized the structure of the funding, giving the state substantial control over how and where the money is spent. He questions whether that adequately recognizes Navajo's sovereign relationship with the state. A coalition of Pacific Northwest tribes is heading to Washington, D.C. this month to call for the removal of dams on the Lower Snake River to bring salmon back to the area. KXLY reports dozens of tribal leaders will attend the event on the steps of the U.S. Capitol. It's part of what's known as the Orca Salmon Project that includes advocacy from tribes in Washington, Oregon, and Idaho. The dams are largely responsible for the disappearance of salmon in rivers where they traditionally spawn. The station reports if the dams were breached, it would be the largest dam removal in the world. At their annual meeting, the nation's three Cherokee tribes passed a resolution opposing the state and federal recognition for the Lumbee tribe and a number of other groups. The yearly tri-council meeting includes the Cherokee Nation, the United Katoa Band of Cherokee Indians, and the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. In addition to mentioning the state-recognized Lumbee tribe, the resolution includes the Chickamauga tribe, the Moa Band of Choctaw, and the Wolf Creek Cherokee tribe as those not worthy of state or federal recognition. The Eastern Band of Cherokee Tribal Council will consider supporting a name change for the highest point in the Great Smoky Mountains National Park. WLOS News reports the resolution favors changing the name of Klingman's Dome. The recommended name is Kawahi, a Cherokee word meaning mulberry place. Resolution advocates say it is a sacred place where Cherokees prayed and sought spiritual guidance. They say the current name pays tribute to Thomas Clingman, an avowed racist who was a general in the Confederate Army and has no connection to the tribe. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
Expanded school meals for kids are helping with pandemic-related food insecurity. And experts advise remaining tick vigilant as the population of the pesky bloodsuckers increases. Yaz Brown has more on these and other stories from rural America with the Daily Yonder.
For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, this is the news from rural America. Wind power is among the clean energy sources propelling growth in Iowa's green jobs. Working Nation reports that Iowa currently has more than 13,000 green economy jobs, and several thousand more are expected in the next 5 years. Mac Heddens with Power Up Iowa says the state's push toward clean power has caught the attention of large-scale employers, such as Amazon.
The more renewable energy that Iowa has in its power mix, really the more attractive it becomes for some of those companies that prioritize sustainability.
People who have worked in fossil fuel sectors need to know what's coming and where they fit in, suggests Federation of Labor President Charlie Wishman. He wants to see more community conversations.
The market is moving in a certain way, and when we don't plan ahead, workers can suffer.
At the two-year mark, some federal agencies aren't moving fast enough to implement year-old anti-monopoly directives to reduce the disparity and unfair competition between small farmers and big ag, according to Joe Maxwell, president of the Farm Action and Open Markets Institute.
You don't balance that power structure, the farmer is still going to be abused in that system.
The USDA is getting the most heat for its failure to move faster with rulemaking for the Packers and Stockyards Act. The agency says it'll soon roll out another two proposed rules and is committed to vigorous enforcement of existing laws to promote competition. Maxwell isn't satisfied.
We felt very strongly that after a year, they should be further along.
The Institute does commend the Federal Trade Commission and Department of Justice for quick work clarifying product of USA labeling, ensuring farmers' rights to repair their own equipment, investigating more mergers, and starting work on new antitrust protections. Expansion of pre-pandemic school meals will be a summer lifeline for some kids. Daily Yonder journalist Sarah Malott says the benefits will provide at least 95 million meals.
It expands where meal sites are allowed to be. They're also allowed to pick up multiple meals at a time. They don't have to go back and forth every day. They can pick it up one time for a few days.
More than 1 in 10 urban households are estimated to be food insecure, and even more rural households. Summer is supposed to be a time when the living is easy, but stay cautious about ticks.
Generally, I go into every year thinking it's going to be a big year for ticks.
Tim McDermott with Ohio State University Extension says it's a myth that ticks only exist in the woods, and their numbers have been increasing each year for the past decade due to climate change, including species that can cause illness, such as Lyme disease.
I recommend you practice tick-safe behaviors, and they include things like wearing long pants and long sleeves.
To stay safe, a hat and tick repellent also are recommended. For the Daily Yonder and Public News Service, I'm Roz Brown. For more rural stories, visit dailyyonder.com.
An apprentice program trains people for clean energy jobs. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. The clean energy industry is booming, and companies need more licensed electricians who can install solar panels, electric vehicle chargers, battery storage, and more. Vaughn Woodruff is Director of Workforce Development at New England-based Revision Energy. He says the workforce needs to grow quickly in size and diversity.
We need more women involved. We need more representatives from communities of color involved. We need folks with disabilities and veterans and across the board.
But many people cannot afford to stop working to take outside training programs, or they have family commitments that conflict with classes. So the apprenticeship program at Revision Energy's training center is designed to lower these barriers. Revision employees receive paid on-the-job training, classes scheduled around their work, and online lessons to take at their convenience.
And the ability for them to find the time that works best, which oftentimes is weekends or evenings, to be able to do this content is huge.
So more flexible training can help ensure that there are enough qualified workers to meet the growing demand for clean energy. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 8th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes myself, Josh Salem, and Sam Bauman. The co-producers are Althea Billings, Sam Bauman, and Josh Salem, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Eric Tegetoff, Native Voice One, and Mary Sherman. The director of the evening news is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Counterspin.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Saturday in the Park, Vancouver, USA Pride, on Saturday, July 9th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Esther Short Park in Vancouver. This LGBTQ+ Pride celebration includes games, drag queen story hour, education workshops, and more. That's Saturday in the Park, Vancouver, USA Pride, on Saturday, July 9th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Esther Short Park, 400 West 6th Street in Vancouver. More information can be found at kboo.fm